Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you would, please turn your Bibles to the book of 1 Peter, chapter 1. And while you're turning there, I want to once again say how much I appreciate the opportunity of being with you this week. It's just a real honor and privilege any time you are invited to come and spend some time leading a group of God's people in the study of His Word. And I'm so thankful for this series of lessons that I have the privilege of leading our thoughts in. But I certainly want us all to engage in this study together and to be as active in our thinking as we possibly can as we approach the study of God's Word in order that the benefit of our time spent can be maximized. Thank you again for your attention tonight. It's good to look out in the audience and see friends that I've known for many, many years, some who are members here and others who are visiting, and it's just a real pleasure to be reacquainted with old friends. Tonight we're going to talk about trials. I'm not one that's real good at coming up with great titles to sermons. But the idea here that I want to consider is hardships, difficult circumstances that come into our lives and how we respond to those. One of the things that sometimes people are led to believe is that if you become a Christian, that's the end of your problems. You're never any more going to have any hardships, any trials to deal with in your life. And of course, I think we recognize that that is terribly naive, if not false advertising, that some might extend to the world as a motive to become a Christian. The fact of the matter is that becoming a Christian will sometimes eliminate some of the problems that you have in your life. Certain of the problems that sin can bring into our life as we seek to eliminate that sin from our life is going to free us from the burdens that those who come under the burden of sin are going to have to bear. But the fact of the matter is there are a whole lot of trials that are common to the experience of all people in this world that Christians are not immune to. And furthermore, there may be times, and Peter may be in fact primarily dealing with those kinds of situations that come to Christians in particular. Trials that are born that Christians bear that the world itself might not even have to bear. And so we're not going to address a question of whether or not we will encounter trials in our life, but how we are going to face those trials, how we are going to respond to them. I believe in this passage that's open before us, Peter is going to give us about four basic principles that will get us a perspective on hardships and trials in life that will enable them to be endured to begin with. And secondly, that can even make them be beneficial in some way in our life. And that is not to say that we should long for hardship or look for the opportunity to get hurt. But the fact of the matter is, as those things are brought to bear in our life, the way we respond to them can frequently have a detrimental impact upon our spirituality and our lives, or they can have a beneficial impact. And I believe that Peter shows us how to have the latter rather than the former. Let's read together 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through verse 9. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible, full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. The first thing that I would call your attention to is that Peter says trials are real and they cause actual grief. If you'll notice there again in verse 6, he says to the people to whom he writes, "You have been grieved." That's a quote. "You have been grieved," he says. And so trials are a real experience in the human life. And the reaction that we need to have as Christians is not one that says, "Oh, trials are really not any big deal. Yes, I lost a very dear loved one to me, but you know, it's just not that big of a deal. I've got terminal cancer, but you know, that's just one of those things." This sort of just wave of the hand and dismissive attitude toward the hardships and trials that come into our lives, I don't believe is a scriptural one. I don't believe that that's the way Jesus responded to the trials that came into his life. And perhaps we'll have opportunity as the sermon goes on to consider some of that. But Peter here acknowledges the reality of the suffering. He acknowledges the reality of the trial, of the test, of the hardship. Reminds me, those who want to dismiss the seriousness of hardships that come into people's lives, of a cowboy who was hauling his livestock down the highway. And he was involved in a terrible accident. And he was pretty badly injured, and his livestock was severely injured. And a highway patrolman happened upon the scene of the accident, and he walked up, and the first thing he saw was the livestock that was suffering from broken limbs and so forth. And in order to put them out of his misery, he drew his service revolver, and he put them out of their misery. And the injured cowboy in the cab of his truck was looking back and observing this officer as he made his way toward him, shooting these injured livestock. And he finally gets to the cowboy and he says, "Sir, are you okay?" And the man looked at him and says, "Never better." But trials are real. And we do suffer. And when we are under the burden that sometimes this life can bring to bear against us, and someone comes up to us, a brother, a sister in Christ, a family member who cares about us and asks us how we're doing, the answer does not necessarily need to be, "Oh, I've never been better. Just great." Sometimes we ought to share our grief. And I'm not one that just a gusher that goes around and always is woe is me. That's not that's the other ditch, the other extreme that we don't want to careen over into. But the reality is we need to be honest about our feelings and about the tragedies that we have experienced. I've known of husbands who told their wives not to cry over the loss of a child. But how does that square with the fact that Jesus, in that shortest and very famous verse in all the Bible, simply tells us that Jesus wept? A lot of debate as to what exactly was the cause of Jesus' grief on that occasion. But the fact of the matter is, he cried because he was sad. He cried because in some way he was overcome with grief and emotion. And he expressed that emotion. He didn't say, "Oh, Lazarus is dead. I've never been better." Jesus, because of some circumstance involved with that, was grieved. And he vented that grief in a human expression. And so as we grieve as Christians, we are not to become inhuman in some way, stoics, and have the stiff upper lip principle that you never express or acknowledge the reality of your suffering in any way, but you sink down into it. But the difference between the Christian sinking down into his grief is the knowledge that underneath are the everlasting arms. And that somewhere he will be embraced into the loving arms of a Father who he knows cares. And will at some point lift him up and stand him on solid ground once more. That's the Christian's perspective on this. It is not the Stoic's position of denying the reality of the suffering, but rather to throw oneself into the arms of a Father whom we know cares. The thing that we must not do, however, and that I don't want to lend any credence to, is the idea that we can become so overwhelmed by our trials and hardships that we simply give up trying. We give up trying to keep on living life and trying to serve the Lord. We must not do that. We must not abandon our hope. The thing not to do is to despair and quit, but to suffer, to acknowledge the grief, and to put ourselves in the hands of God, who once more can and has the power and the will to lift us up and put us on the track again. And so we have been grieved. And Peter acknowledges as he writes his letter to these people that they have, in fact, been grieved. And we at times will be grieved ourselves. None of us are going to get through this human experience unscathed. And so we must acknowledge the reality of the hardship. The second thing that Peter does is he teaches us that trials are of a relatively brief duration. Trials that we encounter, no matter how severe they are of a relatively brief duration. Again, look at verse 6 where he says, "You have been grieved a little while. For a little while you have been grieved." Now, brief or a little while are expressions that are relative, I recognize. If I say Kyle can hold his breath for a long time,
you recognize in that expression, you're thinking, well, maybe a couple of minutes would be a really long time for somebody to hold their breath. But if I say someone else has had has worked at the same place for a long time, you're thinking 30 years or more. And so a long time or a little while, on the other hand, brief, can have a very relative perspective, can't they? And the trials that you endure may not seem to be brief when compared with the trials that somebody else has gone through in their life. Maybe you've been struggling with something since your birth. Maybe you've had some kind of a defect in your body from the time of your birth that you've had a trial and a struggle with all the way through your life. Or perhaps you've lost a very important loved one, your husband, your wife, many years ago, and you've struggled with the trial of loneliness all these many years. And it doesn't seem to you like it's a little while trial. But what we need to do is not just gather our perspective on the length and duration of our trials by comparing them to the span of this life or to the length of trials that someone else may experience, but get our perspective from the place that the Scriptures call our attention to. We need to compare our trial to the duration that is described of our inheritance in verse 4. Peter says we have this hope of an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. And so there is that perspective that the Christian and the Christian only can bring to his suffering. A perspective that you can bring to your trial, even if your trial is one that seems from a human point of view to be long in duration. When we put it in the eternal perspective, when we compare it with the inheritance that we are promised that does not fade away, then it sort of shrinks and we get the perspective we need to call it brief. If we suffer the every day of our life in this world, if it's hard for us to be a Christian every day of our life in this world from the beginning to the very end, we have all eternity to put that into a little while perspective, don't we? It's hard to do that. I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, but this is a truth that we as Christians are called to sink our teeth into, to get a grip on, to tie that knot, as someone says, at the end of the rope and hold on when things seem like they're more than we can bear. If we can get that eternal perspective, it will give us the strength that we need to get through another day, because we know of an inheritance that does not fade away. In 2 Corinthians 4 and in verse 17, Paul tells us that our little while trials can produce everlasting glory. There he puts it this way: for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Two words I want you to notice there that Paul used: our light and momentary trials, our light and momentary afflictions. Again, we might look at that and say, well, my afflictions are not light. And they aren't momentary. Well, they're momentary again in terms of the eternal perspective. And what Paul is telling us there when he says that they're light is he is not using, as we discussed in the first point, some dismissive attitude toward trials. Oh, it's not a big deal. But he is doing it in terms of a comparison. They are light in comparison with the weight of glory that is promised to the faithful child of God who perseveres to the inheritance that is promised to us in heaven. They're light in comparison to the glory that will be revealed to us and in us in the last day. And so once we get a hold on that eternal and heavenly perspective, we can put our trials in the proper place that they belong. And we should understand that when Paul said this, he wasn't speaking as Lawrence Kelly. I can tell you, and I'll be for the first to admit, that I have not experienced the depth of trials that many of you have. And it would perhaps be absurd for me to try to get up here and on my own authority tell you that you just have a light affliction. And you might rightly fire back at me and say, well, you don't understand anything about affliction. But we're talking about the Apostle Paul, who is the one who pens these words. And he understands what it is to be afflicted. Read the book of Acts. Read the epistles in which he describes the things that he goes through. And so it's not a person that is writing these words who is not acquainted with grief and sorrows and trials. He knew well whereof he spoke. And we're going to look at one of his trials in particular in just a few moments. And so we are getting this light description of our trials in this world from someone who bore things to an extreme degree. Everything that this world can throw at a person, Paul endured. And yet, because he recognized the grandeur and greatness and glory that awaits the true child of God in heaven, he's able to say it's just a light and momentary trouble by comparison. In Psalm 30, in the latter part of verse 5, the psalmist says, "Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning." And so this exhortation is simply to put our trials in that eternal perspective. The third thing that Peter does for us back in our text in 1 Peter 1 is he reminds us once more in verse 6 that we need to understand this about trials. Trials can be used by God to accomplish good. Trials can be used by God to accomplish good. He says again in verse 6, "If need be, you suffer these various trials." Sometimes it's needful. Sometimes it is necessary. Sometimes God himself may deem it necessary for us to be afflicted in order for good to be accomplished. And to us on this side of eternity, once more, that can seem to be ridiculous because we can only see things from this limited frame of reference. It's like if I get my crafts right, and I don't know much about crafts, but a cross stitch might be a good example. The cross stitch that we look at, that's hung on the wall, the finished work, is pretty for us to look upon. We can look up there and see the beauty of it. But again, if I have my crafts right, if you turn around and look at the backside, it's just a bunch of strange and it seems disordered threads going this way and that. It's not the beautiful finished picture that you see on the reverse side. And where we are in this life is on the backside of God's crossed stitch. And sometimes the trials and sometimes the mere what appears to be absurdities of life can make no sense to us from here. But we trust in a faithful Creator who is working in this world and who draws straight with crooked lines. And who takes things that make no sense to us in the here and now and ultimately works them around to accomplish things that are to our advantage. All who have raised children know what it is to have a child who's got a wound, who has scraped their knee or their elbow or something of that sort. And there's some dirt and gravel and other things that are embedded in the wound. And the parent has to take a clean cloth and begin to try to rub what is already a very inflamed part of the tissue in order to clean it and to make it better. And the child, especially the very young child, will not necessarily recognize what mom or dad is trying to do. It seems perhaps from their perspective that they're just trying to add insult to injury. They're adding pain on top of pain. Why are you doing this to me? But the parent with a greater and broader perspective knows that the additional pain is really intended to accomplish a greater end and a greater good. And the Bible tells us in passages that God disciplines us as children. He deals with us as children, and the discipline that he inflicts into our life is very frequently not enjoyable. In fact, no discipline, he says, is enjoyable at the time that it is being received. But it can produce in us something that is to our benefit. Helen Keller once said, "Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened. Vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved." I believe that to be the case. And it requires faith to do so. Again, the thing that pain can do for us above all else is cause us to flee into the arms of God. And this perhaps is the greatest good that suffering and trials can produce. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 19, he puts it this way. Verse 19 of chapter 4, Peter writes, "So then those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator
and continue to do good.
I want to pause here to make very clear a point that I'm trying to get across. Because what could possibly happen is I can get through with the sermon and someone who's experienced some tragic circumstance in their life says, well, preacher, when you got to point number 3 and you said God could accomplish some good, I want you to tell me what possible good could be accomplished through the trial that I am experiencing right now. And I'm here to tell you tonight that Lawrence Kelly does not have the answer to all of those questions. And I'm really quite confident that nobody does. Nobody this side of eternity. I don't know why a particular trial may be endured in a particular person's life. But I do know this, that we are all called to commit ourselves, again, 1 Peter 4, to a faithful Creator, to the belief that God knows what He is doing. That the one who created and sustains this universe is a loving and faithful God who has the best interest of His creatures in view, and that we can commit ourselves and throw ourselves upon Him and trust Him. That's the place we must go. It's the place that Job was called to. Job was never given an explanation for why he suffered as he suffered. The whole point of that was not to give an explanation for the cause and the cause of human suffering and pain. The whole question is to point us to this. In those circumstances, to whom do we go? We cast ourselves at the Almighty and believe Himself to be good. The ultimate example of this is clearly Jesus. And as we look at His life, and He is described as one acquainted with sorrows, well acquainted with grief, and His life of trouble and persecution and trial ultimately concludes in a miscarriage of justice, with the only sinless person to have ever walked this world, the only one to have ever lived with absolutely purely good and loving motives, is then placed upon a tree and crucified and left to die. That's the world's darkest hour. That's as bad as it gets. That's the most horrible thing that could ever possibly happen in all possible worlds, is for the Son of God, the sinless Son of God, to be shamefully crucified and put to death. And I serve a God who can take the worst thing that ever happened and make it into the best thing that ever happened. And that's exactly what it is. And so while I cannot tell you why you may be in some trial and difficulty that you're enduring, I would do this for you. I would call upon your attention to commit yourself to a God who is a faithful God and trust Him. And not allow the occasion that has afflicted you so greatly to become the occasion for you to abandon Him. You may cry out in the, I believe, faithful words of Jesus as He quotes Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And as we follow that psalm out through its conclusion, we see that ultimately it is not a psalm of despair. It is a psalm of faith. It is a psalm crying out to my God and believing that ultimately He will be heard and be answered, as indeed Jesus was, and we will be too. That's the pattern that we must look to. And then the fourth point that Peter calls our attention to is that trials purify our faith in Jesus. And this may be one of the reasons why, if you are going through a hardship, you are going through this hardship. Again, I don't know. I would not presume to point out and tell anyone this is what your trial is about. But here can be, as Peter calls our attention to, one of the most positive and beneficial effects of suffering and trials in our life. It draws us closer to the Lord. It purifies our faith in Him. Notice in verse 7, he says that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Gold is purified by fire, by heat. I don't know a whole lot about the process, but I know that last summer my family was able to go on vacation into Colorado, and we went around the Silverton area and where there was a lot of mining done in the past and some still taking place. And like a lot of mining, it's not so much that they're out just looking for nuggets of pure or near pure gold or silver, but they're trying to find rocks with a high content of those precious metals in them. And that through a process of pounding and pulverizing those rocks until you separate the better from the higher grade from the lower grade, and then wash it through several times, getting more of the dirt and the lesser quality elements away, and then finally heating it up and burning the lesser quality things away so that finally what is left is a pure and valuable substance. It is a trying experience that gold and silver has to go through to reach the point that it's pure enough to be cast as a piece of jewelry. And he says that that's the kind of experience that we go through in this life as well. We're pulled out of the side of the mountain. We're beaten to pieces. We're burned in the fire. And the hotter the fire, the purer the gold, the more refined the faith. We trust, or in times of ease, our trust, our faith can be misplaced. When everything's just going along well for us, we tend to forget who we are dependent upon, don't we? What do you trust in for your well-being? And especially, I would ask that question to those of you who are, things are just going great in your life. You haven't had a really severe testing and trial, and you can't remember when. And everything seems to be going your way. What are you trusting in? Well, I know that everything's going to go my way. Everything's okay because, you see, I've got a wonderful retirement plan. And I bought the car with the highest crash test rating available in its class. And I've just got the best health insurance policy that money can buy. I've got a security alarm system at my house. I've got this, that, and the other. I eat a healthy diet. You know, I take my vitamins. All of these things take care of me, and everything's going to go well. I shall never be moved. I live in a powerful country with a powerful national defense. And I feel secure and I feel safe and everything is okay with me. That is the thing that happens to us, isn't it? We're lulled into that. And I want to say this, I'm not disparaging any of those things in and of themselves. God can use all kinds of means to accomplish His ends. But the problem is that we begin to focus so much on the means that God uses that we forget that He is the one all the while who is using those ends to accomplish His means. And at any time that He should so desire, He can pull the carpet out from under us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verses 8 and 9, we have a very graphic description of how the trials that come into our life pull the carpet out from under us and remove the security blankets and force us to reconsider the true source of our security and of our well-being. Paul there writes, verse 8 of 2 Corinthians chapter 1, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God." Why did it happen? Paul was able, perhaps by inspiration, perhaps just by thinking things through, to recognize this. He was put in a position that was beyond his ability to bear, causing him to despair even of the possibility of being able to survive with his life. And he says that this is why this happened. This happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. Paul tells us that that can be and was for him in that circumstance a value to be found in pressure, a value to be found in hearing the doctor say, "There's no way out of this." Of hearing the bad news that comes to us, because there we are in our fortress and in our security and on all of the things that I've described that we find our security in. And then through one phone call, through one accident, through one turn of events, suddenly we have everything ripped away from us, and there we stand naked before God. And we must learn then that there is nothing
ultimately but Him who can save. Nothing ultimately but Him in whom we may find security and anchor our sense of well-being.
And so these are some things that Peter teaches us
are of great value to be found in trials. The perspective that we have on it being an eternal one and not merely a temporal one. Acknowledging the grief which drives us to trust in God and not in the things of this world.
I would conclude tonight by calling your attention to a few other random details that are not necessarily drawn directly out of 1 Peter chapter 1.
And the first of those that I would call your attention to is something that we mentioned last night, so I'm going to briefly touch on this. And that is never to think of trials as an indication that God has forsaken you. I think that's one of the evil temptations that can come along with hard circumstances in our lives. As we begin to doubt in God's goodness, we doubt in God's faithfulness, or we think for in some way or other we've simply fallen through the cracks. Then God has lost His records regarding me. But that's not the case.
When you go through the pages of the Scriptures, one of the things that will leap out at you if you're noticing this as you go along is how often those who were actually closest to the Lord were the ones who suffered the most. Joseph, whom we talked about last night, had all of these hardships that came into his life, and yet, as we pointed out, it says repeatedly, "And the Lord was with Joseph." Was Job made to suffer more perhaps than any other man because he was a wicked man, because God forgot about Job? Clearly not. The apostles and Jesus Himself, they didn't suffer because God somehow or other was not mindful of them. Not a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the Father's will.
And so we must not think that we are abandoned, but we must commit ourselves to a faithful Creator. The incarnation of Jesus means that we serve a God who has Himself entered into our sufferings.
I don't know about you, but for me there is tremendous comfort.
There is tremendous power that comes to that recognition.
G.K. Chesterton wrote a famous book called The Man Who Was Thursday that really the entire book, I think ultimately, though it's a difficult book to really understand exactly what he's driving at, ultimately focuses on this very point. That many of the people who end up in unbelief or in hatred toward God do so because they ultimately believe that they've been left in this world to rot and to suffer and to go through hardship while God sits serenely in His heaven. And the question is asked at the end of that book, have you ever suffered? And it's asked not really as a true question, but like a railing accusation against God. And the answer in Chesterton's way that only he could, powerfully built up, is simply this. The answer is, can you enter into my suffering? Can you drink the cup of which I drink? No one has ever suffered as Jesus suffered. I don't know the extent of the sufferings that He endured, neither physically, spiritually, emotionally. But this is the God we serve, not one who sits off serenely, not one who sits off abandoning His creation to rot in its own juices, but rather one who comes into the midst of it, gets under all of the pain in order that He might lift it up. And He drinks the cup to the very bottom.
He knows the pain of rejection and betrayal. Is that your trial?
Someone that you love, someone that you've counted on, rejected your love, rebuffed you, betrayed you.
Jesus knows that pain. Is yours the pain of unjustified hatred, people hating you without cause? Jesus knows this as well. Have you lost loved ones? Jesus lost loved ones. Have you suffered physically? Jesus suffered enormously.
The word excruciating comes from the Latin word that describes out of, that means out of the cross. It is a word that had to be coined to describe the kind of suffering and affliction that one endured under crucifixion. And Jesus has endured this. And it is this Jesus who has promised, I will never leave you nor forsake you. There is great comfort in that. There was a little girl who was sick and ready to die. And the doctor had been to see her at her house, and as he was walked to the door by the father, he asked how his daughter was doing, and he said to her father, I'm afraid the time of her departure is near. And so the father returned to the bedside of his daughter, and she looked at him and said, Daddy, does the doctor say I'm going to get better? And he said to her, he determined to speak truthfully and honestly, and he said, no, my dear, he has said you cannot live much longer. And they cried together for a while, and then she looked up at him and she said, as she thought about the loneliness of the grave, the coldness and silence of the tomb, and she said, Daddy, can you go with me? And he said, no, I cannot. And they cried a little bit more, and then she looked up at him and she said, in desperation, can mother go with me? And he said, no, mama can't go yet either. It's not her time. They cried some more, and then finally, with absolute desperation, she looked up at him and she said, Daddy, can Jesus go with me? And with a warmth in his heart that he had not felt since his daughter had fallen ill, he said, yes, Jesus can go with you. And it is comforting to know that there is no place in this world that we can go. Even though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we know that He is with us. And in that, we can find the strength to endure. If you're not a Christian, that ought to be all the motivation that you need in this world to become one. Because apart from Christ, outside of Christ, without Christ, you are hopeless in this world. And in the world to come, you are friendless. There is no one to go with you. And you are all alone. But Jesus has come. He has died for you in order that you might be joined to Him. And you, by confessing your faith in Him, your trust in Him, and loving Him, and confessing that He is Lord and Savior, and being immersed with Him, you can be raised to a new life and be joined with Christ in a bond that can never and will never be broken so long as you continue to have faith in Him and to serve Him. Don't you want that? That's the offer that He extends and that we extend to you tonight while we stand and sing to encourage.